Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There are thrillers such as Blood Simple and the 1978 take on Death on the Nile, international delights Delicatessen and Persepolis, and plenty of tension too with Angel Heart and The Host. We're going to be doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
In this episode of Studio Canal Presents, we're joining in the 50th birthday celebrations for a horror classic, 1973's The Wicker Man. And I'm delighted to be joined by acclaimed filmmaker, writer, director, Mark Jenkin.
Welcome, fool. You have come of your own free will to the appointed place.
Mark's own films, Bait and Ennis Main, might just take some influence from The Wicker Man. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Hi, Simon. I'm very well, thanks.
We always, with our guests on this podcast, ask them to start with just a little bit of a film fact about themselves. I think yours has something to do with a 1980s favourite.
Yeah. Over the recent years, I've been asked a lot about where my love of cinema came from and a key moment in the sort of evolution of my love of cinema. And I always think back to my dad taking me to go and see Crocodile Dundee.
Perfect.
At the local cinema here in Penzance. And he was quite excited about it. And he took me along and they wouldn't let me in because I was too young. But the cinema had just converted the balcony into a second screen. So there was another film on. And the person selling tickets said to my dad, well, you can go and watch this other film. And he said, well, what is it? And it was The Mission.
The Robert De Niro?
Yeah.
Great score to that film.
Yeah, yeah. And so we went and saw The Mission instead. And it really affected me, that film. So some of the images are still kind of, well, you know, the famous images are quite harrowing and seared into my mind. I think it was the first film that I came out of and felt, rather than just being entertained by it, I was slightly traumatized by it, and it had a big effect on me. That was the start of it for me, really, was having a film that I certainly didn't feel like I was enjoying it when I was watching it, which was a new sensation, but it was a film that stayed with me and still with me, and just made me realize what cinema could do other than just being a bit of sort of popcorn entertainment. You could be traumatized and enlightened, and that films could really significantly change you a bit. So I always go back to that.
So are you saying that your career would have been in a very different place if you'd just had some forged ID on you?
I think there's a version of me somewhere that got in to see Crocodile Dundee. And I think that version of me probably isn't a filmmaker.
Okay, I'm not going to ask what that version would be. You talked about films that you can sit and watch, not necessarily enjoy. Enjoyed being the inverted commas words, I think. It leads us on to the film we're talking about a little bit here, 1973's The Wicker Man. I'm just wondering, can you set the film up for us and tell us when it first came into your life?
I don't know, to be honest. I think it's sort of always been there. It's one of those films that I think you know about whether you've seen it or not, because it's such an oddity and such a unique film. I genuinely can't remember the first time I saw it, but it's something I've revisited a lot. And the latest revisiting was earlier this week, because I knew I was going to be chatting to you. I thought I better have another look at it. And because people have mentioned it a lot in relation to Ennis Main.
Yes.
As an influence, you know, people said, oh, it's clearly an influence. And I've never thought of it as being an influence on Ennis Main. And then, so we watched it the other night, and I watched the director's cut, which I've never seen before. And I'd read about the director's cut. I knew about it, and I'd spoken to people about it. And I've spoken to Mark Kermode about the director's cut.
Yeah.
And then recently the kind of people saying, well, actually, is it too soon to now say that the theatrical cut is probably a better film than the director's cut? And I hadn't seen the director's cut. So I watched it and I thought, well, actually, yeah, this is obviously a bit of an influence. But I was speaking to Mary, my partner, about it this morning. I said, maybe it isn't a direct influence. We're just influenced by the same thing. You know, when they were making the film, the sources they were going to was the sources that I went to when I was looking at certain aspects of Ennis Main.
Yeah.
Plus the original book that the film comes from, Ritual,
yeah,
is, I think it's set just here, you know, a couple of parishes over from where I live. I think in the same parish as where Straw Dogs is set. So there's obviously a bit of common ground there. I grew up just over the water from Padstow and the May Day celebrations, which they borrowed the Oss from in The Wicker Man. There's the link to 1973 as well, which is an obvious thing. But also, I really like the fact that you mentioned in the intro there that it could be an influence on Bait as well, because I look at it and think, well, actually, is this more of a... Is Bait more influenced by the sort of folk horror and The Wicker Man, or as much as Ennis Main is?
Hello, sir! Have you lost your bearing?
No, sir, I don't think so. This is Summer Isle, is it not?
It is, sir.
Well, I'm right there. Now, would you send a dinghy, please?
I'm afraid it can't be done, sir. This is private property. You can't land here without written permission.
To answer your question, I think it was probably a film I saw when I was quite young on VHS, which I think is the way, if you haven't seen these on the big screen, that's the way to see these films is on a VHS. And having seen the director's cut, obviously the sequences that are added back in have got that, you know, they look like they've come from VHS because they've obviously come from a broadcast tape, haven't they?
Yeah.
That's a nice reminder of how it would have looked when I probably first saw it. You know, it had that kind of campy, cultish appeal when I was then getting into cinema as a filmmaker. So I would have revisited then. And then, like I say, going back to it this week to have another look.
Don't take this the wrong way, Mark, because you live in a lovely part of the world down there on the South Coast. But if films such as Straw Dogs and The Wicker Man were made in my neck of the woods, I think I'd move. What is it about this part of the world that just invites people to make such terrifying under-your-skin films?
Both of those films are made by outsiders. So I think there's a...
Okay.
You know, they do play to stereotypes. And quite damaging stereotypes at times, you know. But I think both of those films do have... Well, I think Wicker Man, probably more than Straw Dogs, do give a bit of agency to the locals. And
it makes me think of the tourists in your film Bait.
Yeah. Well, and we were watching The Wicker Man the other night, you know, and it was all... We do a sort of film night on a Monday night at my place, and The Wicker Man was the film that we watched. And it was all... You know, all locals, all of the place. And the overwhelming feeling at the end when the Wicker Man was burning was feeling sympathy for the animals. That's where our sympathy was in that scene, you know. So I think maybe there is something in, not having the sympathy and the empathy for the outsider coming in and telling people what to do.
I am here to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. Her name is Rowan Morrison. Would you pass that among your customers, please? Now, if any of you can give me any idea as to her whereabouts, I'd be most grateful if you'd let me know.
Let's have a look at the photograph.
Right.
No, I haven't seen her.
No,
I haven't tried the mainland.
No, I have not seen her.
No.
Mark, you mentioned there the source novel Ritual by David Pinner. And I dug into the history of The Wicker Man, and I'm always fascinated by the films movies nearly became. I had no idea that, for instance, at one stage there was a version of this that would have been directed by Michael Winner, of all people, rather than Robin Hardy, with John Hurt, who was mooted in there. How much of the history of the film are you aware of? Do you tend to come to films cold?
If I'm going to revisit something, I like, you know, I'm sort of obsessive, like, as I imagine you are, you know, constantly reading and... Yeah, and on the internet, looking at all that kind of stuff. So I read the, How Not to Make a Cult Movie book, which is great. I've seen Mark Kermode's documentary that he did, which is, you know, I suppose like 20 years ago now, isn't it? And especially with a film that was, by all accounts, such a nightmare to make and it being pulled in so many different directions.
Yeah.
Those films interest me. I'm very interested in films where the filmmakers are honest. Because every film is a total nightmare to make. If a film is easy to make, then I'm not interested in watching it. But you get a lot of people in the industry who have to tell barefaced lies about how much fun they had and how, oh, that was the best director I worked with, or oh, that was the best actor, and oh,
yeah,
you know, we could never imagine anybody else for that part, and all this bollocks.
There was a tinker lived of late who walked the streets of Rye.
Also in terms of what the film isn't as much as what the film is. I mean, we think of Christopher Lee and horror movies, and the image that springs to mind absolutely isn't the one we get in The Wicker Man. this happy, smiling, singing man is not what many of us were brought up watching Christopher Lee do on screen. And I'm conscious also that he provided some of the finance just to option the novel in the first place. How crucial do you think it is that Christopher Lee, in a weird way, isn't being Christopher Lee to the impact of the film?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that, yeah, not only was involved from the start, but also kind of kept the film alive when it had been released as a supporting feature and then it kind of disappeared. It was him who sort of went out there and did this tour, apparently. And I mean, actors are always heavily invested in films, but maybe not quite as heavily invested as he was. And maybe that is motivated by him wanting to subvert people's expectations of who he was, you know. And I think that was the kind of attraction for casting him in the first place, wasn't it? Was that they wanted to use his reputation and his legacy as a horror star, but then do something completely new, which is an interesting, commercially motivated idea.
It's most important that each new generation born on Summer Isle be made aware that here the old gods aren't dead.
And what of the true god, to whose glory churches and monasteries have been built on these islands for generations past?
Well, he's dead. He can't complain. He had his chance, and in modern parlance, blew it.
But, I mean, thank God they did, because without him, maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation. The fact that he did keep the film alive and went out and just kept it in the public consciousness.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it could have been lost had he not hit the road?
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, you don't really hear of actors doing that.
No.
Not out of choice, but, you know, working actors don't really have the time to kind of do that, or maybe the agency to be able to claim the film as their own. Because I think what's interesting to Wicker Man is there's so many people who kind of can lay a claim to the film. You know, Robin Hardy's never talked about in isolation. It's this kind of group of people that came together to make this film. Christopher Lee's very important in that.
The other one, of course, being Anthony Schaefer, the screenwriter of the film, who, I mean, just looking through the work that he'd done, I mean, he wrote the play Sleuth. He wrote the screenplay for Hitchcock's Frenzy as well. Writers are often overlooked when talking about film. It's a bit of a bugbear of mine. But again, just in terms of what Schaefer puts on the screen and that working relationship they have, it again feels quite interesting to me what they don't do with the movie. Barely any gore, for instance, and an awful lot of singing.
In the woods there grew a tree, and a fine, fine tree was he.
And on that tree there was a limb, and on that limb there was a branch.
The tonal majesty of the film, what they managed to pull off between that creative partnership, can you just give us a flavour of just how difficult that is to do?
Well, I don't think you can plan it.
Yeah.
Maybe it is because it had all of these different voices in there. You know, for somebody like me, who's kind of famous for not collaborating and tries to be as many head of departments as I possibly can, for me it's a really good advert of what you can achieve through collaboration. But I think the collaboration was the fact they were all pulling in completely different directions. And part of it is the writer, you know, I think, because he's a playwright.
Yeah.
Theatre is much more of a writer's medium. Yeah. And as a playwright, kind of like either ignorant or more likely completely unwilling to be overlooked. Whereas if you are like, you know, if you've always been a screenwriter, maybe you're used to nobody giving you any credit for anything.
But yeah.
I think as a playwright, you go into that going, well, this is mine to a certain point.
Do you think there's more patience in playwrights, just in terms of how they stage their stories?
Yeah, I suppose inevitably there is, because there's less kind of commercial risk aversion at play, pardon the pun. Whereas with a film, because films will inevitably cost much more money, is much more money at risk, they'll be risk averse from the start, which is why I think writers get kind of maligned. And it was maligned all the way through, I think, this film, because they brought Robin Hardy in, you know, an experienced director, but hadn't done a feature film before. So then Waxman was brought in to shoot it and had maybe been given some direction that was maybe counter to what the director wanted to do, you know. So there's all this sort of risk averse tactics going on that usually really screw films up, and, you know, and it's why most films ultimately are a bit like, ugh, you know, by the time you get to the end of the very complicated process, it's been watered down so much, and, you know, and the writer's original vision that may have been formulated with a director or maybe not, is kind of lost, and it's just this sort of attempt at a one-size-all vanilla style movie that just isn't risking a huge amount of money. And I think maybe that's what they were certain people were trying to do with this movie, but for once, everybody just kept pulling in different directions. You know, the old, what they say about it, is it written as a horror, shot as a musical, kind of interpreted as science fiction, or, you know, whatever that sort of thing is. And the tonal inconsistencies are the thing that kind of sink most films. And for some reason, it's the tonal inconsistencies that make this film great, because there's no other film like it. I mean, even watching it the other night, you know, a couple of people I don't think had seen it, or certainly hadn't seen it for decades, and were just like, what is this? And Mary, my partner, was like, I cannot remember if I've seen this, because none of this is sort of ringing a bell. We're constantly, films, or, you know, content, as it's now called.
Yes, that lovely word.
Tonal inconsistency is like the new, it's the new thing to sort of avoid. Like, it used to be, oh, never bore your audience, you know, that was the big sin. And now it's like, you know, you've got to be consistent. People have got to know what they're watching. Whereas up until the end, you don't know what you're watching with The Wicker Man.
It's really unsettling, isn't it? I think the music is a huge part of it. You touched on the musical element of it there. I mean, it rips up every rule that you would have for a horror film with that. We're supposed to have really creepy score done with lots of strings. And here we're just having a sing-song.
Show the sergeant to his room, will you?
Much has been said of the strumpets of yore, of wenches and bawdy house queens by the score. But I sing of the baggage that we all adore, the landlord's daughter.
Because the music's a weird thing, isn't it? Because it's not like a musical where you go, the rules of reality are thrown out and suddenly all the characters are singing. And because of our amazing suspension of disbelief, we just go with it. And because musicals have been in the world for so long, you know, that we just go, oh, right, all the characters are now singing and nobody's going, hold on a minute, why are we all singing? It's just kind of accepted. So it's not that. It's kind of diegetic, the singing in the pub and all of that kind of stuff. And then the singing as part of rituals and stuff like that. So it's all part of the film, but it does kind of sit on top of the film as well, partly because of the way it's produced. You know, it's not recorded live when they were shooting.
Yeah.
So that's an unplanned level of abstraction that's built into it. And maybe at the time that wasn't noticeable, but now where everything is so natural and,
yeah,
you know, even though most films are ADR'd for months, you don't notice that the sound's done in post. Whereas you listen to that, you think they're all kind of lip syncing to stuff that's been added over the top. So that's an unintentional level of abstraction that is quite creepy, I think, which I use in my work as well, by post syncing everything. You know, there is a level of abstraction there that you get for free just by employing that particular technique.
Yeah.
But the sort of innocence of the music as well, you know, it's they're simple folk songs that are written and designed and arranged so that anybody can sing them. So it's got an innocence to it, which is counter to the sinister sort of intention of, you know, that you don't quite know what the intention of the community is, but there's a creeping sense that he's not there for the reasons he thinks he's there. And then that's really countered by this kind of almost like nursery rhyme style,
yeah,
folk music.
So bright and outdoors, so much of it as well.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? That the horror plays out in the daylight.
Yes.
You know, that the end sequence, if that was at night and there was a fire burning, there are shadows that you can escape into. There are things that you can't see that are scary, but there is also, you know, the cover of night. The daylight makes it utterly terrifying, because you just get a real sense that this isn't happening in the shadows, this is happening out in the broad daylight, and that really hammers home the fact that there is nobody coming to help.
Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Let's head into spoiler territory then. Let's have a look inevitably at that ending. I don't know if you've considered your own mortality, Mark, but I, when I consider the ways that I want to go, there is a mild appeal to having Christopher Lee leading a sing-along while waving his arms around. I could live without being burnt to death, but Christopher Lee just singing me to my maker, there's something in that.
Yeah, I don't know. It wouldn't be top of my list, I don't think.
Bring him up, oh God. No! No! Think! Just think what you're doing! In the name of God, think what you're doing!
That sequence at the end, one thing re-watching the film that I hadn't appreciated is just how much time Robin Hardy's camera spends inside the Wicker Man. And just how late it is before we see Edward Woodward just perish, effectively. and he holds it for such an extraordinary amount of time.
Oh God! Oh Jesus Christ!
That's one of the two things of that ending that really gets under my skin, and the other being the increasingly long shot of them just all in a line having a song. And the two things joined together, I just think, are incredible.
Yeah, and on the director's cut, they've added in another shot of them singing in the line.
I don't think I could cope.
I think it's actually a repeat. It's the same shot again, but it's that sense that not one person within that swing. And what it reminded me of, it's the Cliff Richards mistletoe and wine dance that he did on Top of the Pops. I thought maybe that's where he got it from. This sort of very Christian, famously Christian Cliff Richard is actually like this pagan sacrifice dance on Top of the Pops while singing Mistletoe and Wine. Which I don't know if anybody's asked him about that.
It's a very logical link to draw.
Yeah, but I think what is unnerving about the end of that film, I don't want to sound like an old git film romantic, all the old days of making films better, but you know there's no special effects there. So when the camera does stay with him in The Wicker Man and you're looking at that, that is all happening for real. And that adds to the anxiety because, again, the suspension of disbelief, you can... I think at the same time you can appreciate what the character's going through, but also what the actor's going through, and thinking, "Jeez, cut away, because this is on fire and he's clearly there. The animals are still clearly there, and it's
the noise of the animals.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And like I say, maybe it is our pagan heritage here, but certainly everybody was watching it. Nobody was worried about the human in The Wicker Man, everybody was worried about the animals. And, and doing that for real is kind of really powerful when you watch it. And also the heads falling at the end and revealing the sun.
Yeah.
You get given gifts, like, I'm going to sound like a character from The Wicker Man. You get given gifts.
Do it in song.
You get given gifts from the natural world. Andrew Cotty said it to me, and I think it was Ian Sinclair said it to him, the angels of happenstance. If you leave yourself open to mistakes and things, the angels of happenstance will provide you with things. And I think, doing it all for real and getting one shot at it, everybody's sort of focus and energy and adrenaline is all going in one direction. And what Mother Nature gave back was the sun dipping just as the head finally falls in the flames.
Yeah.
You could never have planned that, but you leave yourself open to it and the angels of happenstance will provide. So that whole end sequence is just, it could have been so bad. Things could have gone...
Well, we saw that. We saw the other version of it. I mean, I don't want to touch mercilessly on the remake, but let's just say decisions probably went the other way there.
I haven't seen it.
Sadly, not a Studio Canal film, so I will turn quickly in the other direction.
I've seen the clips.
Oh, we've all seen the clips. Just to kind of wrap this up then, you talked about the director's cut quite a lot there, and there are three different cuts of The Wicker Man. Do you lean towards any in particular?
The director's cut is new to me. I've seen the unrestored version where it looks like it's just a sort of U-matic tape that's dropped in with the extra scenes. I love the theatrical version because I like films that are 87 minutes long.
Yes.
Because now you're not allowed to make a film that's under like 3.5 hours long. To get something that's 87 minutes long, it's just so joyous to watch it.
People assume it's a mistake as well, if it's under an hour and a half now.
Yeah.
They assume it's just been hacked to bits or something rather than it's been chosen.
Yeah, when we did Ennis Main, I remember being asked to pitch it, and I hate pitching my film ideas, and I was asked to pitch it, and they said, "What is it?" And I said, "It's a Cornish horror film about a standing stone, and it's 87 minutes long." And that's before I'd even written the script. And I was so determined to make it 87 minutes, but it was 91 in the end.
Can I do anything for you, Sergeant?
Oh, I doubt it. Seeing you're all raving mad.
At the moment, I'm thinking a lot about the director's cut because I've only just seen it. The theatrical cut is kind of significant for me because when we were planning Ennis Main, my big worry was, because none of Ennis Main is shot on an island.
Yeah.
How do you establish that this is an island when we're not shooting it on an island? And I thought, well, The Wicker Man's shot on an island. I'll see what they did. And so I did revisit it when we were prepping for Ennis Main.
Yeah.
And the theatrical cut just starts with a title sequence of an aeroplane flying over islands and then reaching an island. I thought, well, that's the key. you just put a whacking great big shot of an island at the beginning, and you don't have to sort of say that again. You know, the audience are intelligent or stupid or, you know, trustworthy enough to believe what they're being told. And so if you show an island, it's on an island. So having watched the director's cut, it was then like, oh, it doesn't start with that. It starts on the mainland, but also does feel island-like. And that kind of confused me. So I haven't seen the final cut,
yeah,
which is shorter again, right?
Yeah.
Theatrical's 87, then the director's 99, and then they cut,
yeah,
5 minutes out again for the...
It's a bit like Spielberg with Close Encounters, isn't it?
Yeah, or Apocalypse Now.
Yes. I'm not sure anyone ever finally came up with a version they absolutely loved. I think they all stand up. I don't think you can go wrong with any of them in the case of The Wicker Man.
Yeah, well, I look forward to seeing the final cut.
Well, the final cut is part of the remastered Wicker Man package that arrives on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray for the first time on 25th of September 2023. It's on Blu-ray 2, and The Wicker Man is also available on the Studio Canal Presents channels on ITVX Premium, Apple TV and Prime Video. Just before we let you go then, Mark, one thing we like to ask our guests is to pick a double bill from the Studio Canal catalogue of films. And I think you've picked a couple of titles. I've got no idea what they are. What have you chosen for us?
Well, first off, I actually picked two double bills. I'll mention the first one just in passing because it was the one that I gravitated to, which was Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire.
Nice.
But I'm not going to choose that.
Oh, okay. I was ready there.
But the reason I chose that is I watched Mulholland Drive the other day again. I've seen it several times. And I was in LA a couple of months ago and we were up on Mulholland Drive. And I thought, oh, I really want to watch it when I get back. So watched it again. Haven't seen Inland Empire. So I thought that'd be a good double bill. A film that I had seen, a film that I hadn't seen. And I've had Inland Empire here on my table for ages in the pile of stuff to watch. But then I thought, no, it's a bit too obvious. So I went for a Alberto Cavalcanti, if that's how you pronounce his name, double bill, which is two Ealing films. Went the Day Well, which is one of my favourites, probably my favourite Ealing,
yeah,
comedy.
It was Saturday morning when those army lorries came rumbling along the road from Upton. We'd have laughed if you told us we'd got a real live German right under our very noses.
And an Ealing horror, which I thought would be relevant today, which was Dead of Night.
Yes.
He directed the famous ventriloquist section and one of the other sections. But I thought that'd be a good one because I also haven't seen Dead of Night. I've seen that one section, but I haven't seen the whole film. So I thought, for selfish reasons, I'd put on a double bill that would mean that I would have to go along as well because I haven't seen one of the films. So that would be it, yeah. Went the Day Well and Dead of Night.
Fine choices, and Dead of Night, whenever it comes up on this podcast, always gets an extra round of applause for me for the novelty golf sequence. And so if you've not seen it, what a treat you have to come.
Well, I'm going to actually do that double bill at one of our Monday night film clubs, I think.
Oh, lovely. Well, the ventriloquist dummy, absolutely terrifying. The golf sequence, proof that you can never have bad golf in a movie.
I'll look out for that.
Well, that's that. Grand finish to a grand game.
An almost incredible finish.
Mark Jenkins, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Now it's time for some news from the world of Studio Canal. Wicked Little Letters is a film we've talked about briefly before on the podcast. Starring Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley, it's inspired by a true story, and it sees Colman and Buckley playing two neighbours who seemingly have nothing in common in 1920s England. Yet the appearance of some particularly scathing written correspondence upends both of their lives. Thea Shurrock directs, and the film now has a confirmed UK release date. It's going to be in cinemas on February the 23rd, 2024, and we'll have more on it nearer the time.
There's a word in Korean, inyeon. It means providence or fate.
Do you believe in that?
That's just something Koreans say to seduce someone.
Much closer at the time of recording is the theatrical release in the UK of Past Lives. Now, this is the directorial debut of playwright Celine Song, and it's already one of the best-reviewed films of the year. In fact, it's enjoyed an excellent response from its festival screenings as well, recently winning the Audience Award at Sundance London. Past Lives is a heart-rending modern romance. It opens in cinemas on September the 7th, 2023.
The guy flew 13 hours to be here. I'm not going to tell you that you can't see him or something.
Sometimes the world of the dead gets mixed up with the world of the living.
Finally, on home formats, Alejandro Amenábar's acclaimed 2001 psychological horror The Others is to enjoy a special release and 4K restoration. Starring Nicole Kidman, the film was a box office hit on its original release and has remained a firm spooky favourite since. It's making its 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray debut on October the 2nd, 2023.
Where is my daughter?
Are you mad? I am your daughter.
I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. I'm delighted to say I'll be joined by writer Paul Laverty and director Ken Loach for a delve into their new film, The Old Oak. Until the next time, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. I'm just off now to have a few more nightmares about Christopher Lee plotting my demise while singing a song. Ta-ta for now.